Good evening again. That was really nice, the level of energy that was in the room during the break. Maybe we could bottle that. Wow. So this talk is the third in a series, and it's about the nature of Buddhist community, really. And for those of us who are fortunate enough to be in some kind of role where we can help guide the community, whether we get to sit up here, or whether we're on the board of directors, or play some other role, I feel that we have an obligation to be knowledgeable at some level about the historical development of community and sangha, what was important, why it worked, why it didn't work. That was the first talk. The second talk was about kind of the contemporary development of Buddhist community in the West. And so you end up with a community like this that I think it's fair to call it a Theravadan base, Theravadan being the original school of Buddhism. But it's Theravadan based. It's based on core teachings, but we're not adhering to a lot of the forms of the original Theravadan approach. And then tonight, what I'd like to talk about are four specific elements that if communities get them right, I think they succeed, generally speaking, and if they don't get them right, they don't succeed. And there's many. I mean, each one of these talks could have been like a whole series of talks, and the four that I'm going to talk about tonight, we could take any one of them and do multiple evenings on it. So once again, this is kind of an overview, and I think that I'm going to talk for a while, and we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers and discussions, and I'm hoping that some of this is a little provocative and makes all of us think about community. So the place I want to start tonight is I'd like to put this in context, and even for the folks who haven't been here before or who have never heard anything about Buddhism, I'm going to talk about two principles and try to make them really practical. So in Buddhist practice, regardless of the school, it is said that there are three fundamental characteristics of existence, and they're normally referred to in the Pali, this original language, and they are anicca, anatta, and dukkha, and generally translated into English. Anicca means change or impermanence. Anatta means no self or the absence of a permanent continuing self, and dukkha means suffering. And then the four foundations of mindfulness and the fourfold path the Buddhist practices is all about those things, about suffering and how to resolve it and how to find happiness in our lives. So I want to talk about anicca and anatta, impermanence or no self, because I think most of us relate to these as difficult ideas or ideas that we can understand philosophically, but how they actually, I mean, in real time, relate to our practice and community, I think is a mystery for a lot of people. So we've done two Saturday retreats kind of revolving around these issues. And for me, these two ideas are not complex, and they're actually quite direct, and it is clear from a practice perspective that they are fundamental to having deep practice. So there's many ways you can explain this, but this is the way I want to put them in context tonight for a discussion of community. Okay? Okay. So anicca, or the idea of change or impermanence, seems almost obvious, right? I mean, we all go, oh yeah, of course. Everything's changing. Yeah? I mean, like, what could be more obvious? And that's not what we're talking about from the perspective of Buddhist practice. Because the notion of change and impermanence from a Buddhist perspective, regardless of school, is based on the Buddhist idea of causation. So that everything that is present here in this moment, it is, yes, changing. Now it's changed. And now it's changed again. And now it's changed again. And what anicca or impermanence or change is about is the way that is changing, because if we can understand the way it's changing, it gives us a path into understanding our own states of mind and practice. So the way that it's changing are two things. The first thing is that this moment right now, which now has changed, but for sake of discussion, this moment right now is dependent on the moment that immediately preceded it. If the moment preceded it was not there, this moment wouldn't be here. So that's the first thing. So change is wholly dependent on what precedes it. It's not just that things are changing, and it's specifically that what precedes this moment has a relationship to this moment. Okay. The second notion is that what immediately precedes this moment conditions or influences this moment. So for example, if in the moment that I was explaining this, you just kind of had a little phase out moment, right? You have no idea what I'm talking about now. You may not have any idea anyway, based on. But if in that moment you were distracted, you were thinking something else, you heard something outside, you looked out the window so that your attention was distracted, then your understanding of this moment is different because you missed something, okay? And if your attention was really focused, it was like, wow, I mean, like, he's actually saying something that's important. I'm really listening. Then, like, maybe a light bulb goes on. Because this notion that this moment is dependent on and conditioned by the moment that precedes it explains everything. Okay, the Buddha in the Satipatthana Sutra said that all of our practice, what we want to do, is that we want to see the following. We want to see what causes a mind state to arise. What causes it to stay here or to increase intensity, and what causes it to dissipate and go away. How do we know that? We look to the moment before. Because mind states, anger, depression, fear, resentment, happiness, joy, lust, we're not just attacked by those. They appear based on the conditions that precede them. So if we can just start watching our own conduct and use that as the model, suddenly you start seeing all kinds of things if you're watching in that way. Is this working so far? Okay. Now, this sounds like really simple and straightforward, and try to do it. Right? You know, just like when you first start to meditate, like, you know, you think, oh, gee, what could be so difficult? I'm going to close my eyes and focus on my breath. Right? And you find out your mind's all over the place. Well, this is of the same order. It is simple in the sense that it is straightforward. But we have to train our mind to observe in this particular way. But if we do, it pays off. It pays off in a big way. So that's anicca, impermanence, change. It's dependent and contingent. So what does no self mean? And you've heard me say this before, but I think that I wish we would just stay with the Pali terms that we don't understand what they mean. Because then we wouldn't bring all this baggage along, right? Because, I mean, just the idea of, like, well, gee, anatta means no self. You know, and most of our minds are going, no self. Well, you know. So I prefer that we just call anatta like spaghetti, you know, or enchilada, or something, just anything, you know. So, okay, let's define what that means. And so what that means is that if every moment is changing, and every moment is dependent upon and conditioned by the preceding one, there is nothing, without exception, well, there's one exception, which I'll explain in a moment, but almost nothing, only one exception, that is permanent, that has a separate, identifiable identity to it. It's not separate because it's what?
Conditioned.
It's dependent and conditioned. So it can't be separate, right? And so this is why we talk about Indra's net, that there's this huge net of everything completely interrelated and dependent and conditioned on everything else. Okay? So whatever is present in this moment is here, but it is empty of any separate, permanent identity. And if you just think, although, you know, we all hold the idea that, you know, I'm the same person that woke up this morning, just think of all of the different mind states that you had today and the different ways you felt and everything, you know, just constantly changing, okay? So, how does this apply to community? Okay. I can see people saying, yeah, how does that apply to community? Oh, and by the way, okay, the one thing that is unconditioned is awakening. That's the single thing that when the mind completely awakens, it becomes unbounded. Okay. All right. So, how does this apply to the community? Before we all got here tonight, there was no community sitting in this room. Right? So we all got here, and how did we get here? Well, for every single person in this room, our getting here was dependent on something. You know, there was an intention to get here, there was a desire to do this rather than something else, our car had to work. Right? And how we got here and what immediately preceded influenced how we felt. So like if we had a really busy day, we got here in our first sitting, we just snoozed through the sitting. Or if we didn't have that kind of day and we were really excited about being here, our minds were really awake. And then we break and there's this incredible energy in the room, which is different than the energy of last week. Why is it different? It's because of all of these circumstances that brought us here and who each one of us individually are, all coming together, and then at some point we're going to ring the bell and we're all going to disperse and there's not going to be any community in this room. Now, we'll come back again sometime, but it'll be different because it's not going to be all the same people. And all the people who are here are going to have a different state of mind when they arrive. So, for me, community coming together and leaving and coming back together, you know, is just a Nietzschean and not an action. You know, our being here is completely dependent on all kinds of things. What happens here is completely dependent and influenced by everyone's participation. And when it's over, it's over. We're gone. There is no continuing permanent community. We have to recreate it over and over and over again. Got that? It's an act of creation. Okay? So, there are a number of things that in this act of creation, if we get right, sustain communities and make them thrive, and if we get it wrong, it's just the reverse. And I'm not sure about subsequent trainings. I haven't asked anybody, but when I went through my training program at Spirit Rock, We had 84 people from all over the United States, Canada, several from Europe, and several from Israel. All of them representing individual sanghas. And the thing that for me was kind of initially shocking is in talking with people, I did a lot of breakout sessions about forming sanghas and working with sanghas because I've been very active in helping form some communities in this town and other cities. And so we'd get together and talk about this, and so you had probably 60 different community sanghas represented in the 84 people. And the vast majority of them, and I mean like 80%, fell apart after 5 to 7 years of operating. And the falling apart process almost always related to one of the four things that I'm going to talk about today. Okay. So the other contextual thing that I'd like to lay out before I get to the four things. Somebody's saying, when is he going to get to the four things? Is, this is, in my opinion, an objective, truthful assessment of Dharma communities. The nature of Buddhist communities, you know, the Buddha said that the reason that we come to practice is that we're suffering. And that that suffering either spurs us on to find the end of suffering and find some satisfaction and peace in our life, or it drives us into more suffering. Okay. So the nature of Buddhist communities are that, and I believe that this is no exception to that rule, is that there are a lot of wounded people sitting in this room. Now, we may have healed at different levels, but I know I came to practice because I was wounded in all kinds of ways. And from talking with probably the majority of people in this room, you know, I know that that's the case. So the significance of that in terms of the context of this talk and these four elements is that we come into practice because we're suffering, and we may not be fully aware of the levels of our suffering and how it affects our thinking and our conduct and our judgment. And so people come to communities like this because they are seeking refuge, right? And it's a wonderful thing. And in terms of like getting up on top of and understanding the operation of sanghas and the problems of sangha, it's also important to understand that people who are wounded and who aren't fully aware of their wounding bring that into the way they relate to a whole series of important dynamics in community, which can make things really complex. Okay? So, anybody have any idea what the four are? The four things. That's where we're going to go now. Okay? So, so that wasn't a rhetorical question. This is an invitation. Okay? So it just popped from. Okay, so any idea what the four are?
Parking.
Well, actually, I'm going to talk about that. But so, okay, other than parking.
Personal agendas.
That could certainly relate to it. It's not specifically what I'm looking for, but it's kind of like a subset.
Okay. Ego?
No. Okay, I'm looking for very specific things. Everything that anybody mentions will feather in, but I'm looking for four big things. Okay.
How you react?
Like a guru syndrome. They're looking for somebody to save them. Or
well, that would be kind of like the whole transference issue is very, very complex. And so, okay, so Number one that I'm good is power.
It's power.
Okay, power. And power manifests itself in all these different dynamics in terms of governance, okay? And certainly the student-teacher and teacher-sangha relationships, I mean, it can be really complex. Okay, so the first one that I'm going to talk about is power. Okay, what's the next one?
Money.
Money. Okay? It's like the topic actually that no one in spiritual communities wants to talk about. Okay? All right. There's another one, the third one that people in spiritual communities don't want to talk about. Okay?
Conflict.
What?
Conflict.
Well, that's kind of a subset. It's in conflict resolution. Okay? So, and as I say, we could go on for a long time, you know, diversity, what have you. So I'm just going to focus on four tonight. So
sexual misconduct.
Sex. Okay, so power, money, sex.
Okay. And rock and roll.
Wow. Number four. Okay, so and now there's number four. There's number four. And this one I'm going to predict no one will guess. Okay. If someone guesses it, you're going to get some kind of special award. Okay, so anybody have any idea? Number four?
Leadership.
No, leadership would be part of power.
Getting special awards.
What?
Getting special awards.
Getting special awards?
Okay.
Money, power, sex.
Death.
Huh?
Death.
Place, location.
Death.
I don't know. Okay, okay.
Trying to make something permanent, try to recreate the same thing again and again.
Well, yeah, I mean, for sure. Okay. But yeah, like not honoring any chananata. Okay.
So can we call a lifeline?
Yeah. Okay, number four.
Dependent.
Number four. Okay, I'm going to talk about number four when I get to it. Okay. No, it's coming, it's coming. And it's important, okay? I'm serious. It's important as the first three. Okay, so first of all, power. All right? Okay, so the issue of power, and actually in a smaller community as opposed to a larger community, it is actually quite difficult and complex. Because in a larger community, you know, there's a larger container where the energy around leadership styles, communication problems, well-intentioned but misguided actions. I mean, you know, we could make a whole list of things that have to do with leadership and governance. But in a larger organization, there is a larger organization and a larger space and a larger governance organization that can kind of absorb and work with all of this. In a group this size, you know, the reality of it is, you know, we've got a pretty full house tonight, but this organization is run by a handful of people. And unless that handful of people, it's a little bigger than a handful, but it's a small group of people, and unless that group of people are really on the same page and in sync, boy, you can just start bumping into all kinds of problems really, really quickly, and things can go downhill. And one of the big things is, in addition to, you know, confused leadership styles, miscommunication, personal agendas. You know, that people are putting their personal agenda ahead of the best interest of the organization. Okay. So I'd like to read something to you tonight that I don't know if you've ever heard this, or it's been a while since you heard this, but when this has been in use with this community and our board for at least 12 years in various versions, and this is the current version, and this is the board of directors' effort to help board members stay focused on what it is that we're trying to do and how we're trying to do it. Okay? So I've actually taken that I do a fair amount, I'm a lawyer by trade, and I do a fair amount of nonprofit work, and I've taken these guidelines and adapted them for a number of clients that I have. So at the beginning of every meeting of our board of directors, this is read, and there's five items, and each one is read by a different member of the board. And we start with a short sitting, and then we read these to each other as a reminder of what we're trying to do. So we commit to using our participation on the SIM board as Dharma practice. So right off the bat, it's owning responsibility individually and then as a group for turning what we're doing in terms of managing the life of the organization as a Dharma practice, okay? So number one, we will stay connected to and focused on serving the Dharma and the SIM community. We will refrain from advancing or arguing for our own personal agendas. Number two, we will see, understand, and work with board experiences using the skills and perspectives of meditative awareness. And these were originally drafted using, when this was first drafted and our mission statement, which is on the wall out there, we talked about meditation and meditative awareness because mindfulness had not become a big buzzword. Okay, so we're always talking about so here, when we use meditative awareness, we're basically talking about mindfulness. Okay, number three, and this one is a little long because little things, there have been additions to it. It's become a little bit of a laundry list. But if you read it slow, it's a good reminder, okay? We will cultivate an open and balanced mind, clear seeing, cooperation, collaboration, non-harming, generosity, kindness, compassion, and equanimity in communicating and working with the board and community members and in conducting board meetings. Four, we will cultivate awareness of reactivity and work to diminish its influence in our intentions, thoughts, speech, and behavior. That's pretty good, isn't it? I mean, this is a wonderful set of reminders. Okay, number five, we give each other permission to honestly and caringly alert one another to concerns about unmindful and unskillful speech or behavior during meetings. We will receive such concerns with respect and openness. We will discuss and work with these concerns in a candid, honest, and skillful way. So I think this is actually fairly demanding, you know. And so that's it, at least our deepest intention on the board of how we're going to try to conduct ourselves and conduct the business of assignment. The second thing, at least for this community, about governance, and I don't know if we ever had a discussion explicitly about it. I guess it seems obvious, but I think it's helpful to talk about it, is that we are actually a corporation. You know, we are a community, but as an organization, we are a not-for-profit corporation, and we have been granted the privilege of tax-exempt status, where, you know, like if you write checks and come in, you get a statement from us and you can take that off your taxes. And that is entirely conditioned on our behaving in certain ways. Okay. And in from my perspective, they're completely consistent with behaving dharmically. You know, so governing the organization is a dharmic act, and it also lines up with the legal requirements. So basically the legal requirements are they're called fiduciary responsibilities, okay? And the overriding fiduciary responsibility is that the board is to act in the best interests of sacramental insight meditation in this community. That's the obligation of the board, and it basically breaks out into three specific fiduciary responsibilities. The first one is that any action that we take actually supports our mission, our vision, and our means. And I'm going to go over that in a second. So the first one is action itself. Anything that we do, defining what is in the best interest, is looking to what our mission and our vision and our means are. The second one is that we act financially responsible, and that anything we do financially supports the mission, vision, and the means. And the last responsibility is that we discharge those first two duties, which are pretty big duties, with due diligence and care, both in terms of making decisions, you know, that we're careful, you know, that we do the amount of research that we need to make a sound decision, and in overseeing the activities of, you know, the consequences of our decisions. Okay? So that in terms of money management, whatever it may be, that those are our three fundamental responsibilities. So my guess is, just because we're all habits of creature, is that most of us walk in and, you know, there's right on the wall, right in front of us, is our mission statement and everything. And my guess is that when was the last time, you know, that we looked at it, okay? So I just want to read parts of this, because the three fiduciary responsibilities I just talked about relate to this, and up to this entire community, okay? So our mission is to serve as a learning, training, and community center for the development, integration, and skillful use of meditation practice and awareness in all aspects of individual, family, institutional, work, and community life. So it's about bringing this into every aspect of individual and community. Our vision, our mission is based on this vision. Insight, Vipassana meditation, and meditative awareness are powerful resources for living, problem solving, and transformation. I love that. I just think that's so beautiful. Our powerful resources for living, problem solving, and transformation. The continued individual and community exploration and development of these resources leads to a life of clarity, balance, and peace, expressed in the form of generosity, wisdom, compassion, and ethical conduct. These experiential results provide a basis for enormous hope for the physical, emotional, and spiritual health and well-being of each of us, our families, our institutions, and our communities. So I really find these two pieces quite beautiful, you know, as what we're trying to do. And then there are seven means outlined, have to do with the programs that we kind of offer, the type of environment, an environment of safety and inclusivity, training, support. There's a whole series of things. I'm not going over that. I'm hoping people are going to go out and look on the wall. So, okay. So that's what guides, or what we're hoping and what we're trying to guide our use of power in this organization. Okay, so secondly, money. You know, I think in most Dharma communities, and particularly small Dharma communities, there's actually a lot of avoidance about money and addressing money and talking about money. It's like part of the reason I came here is I don't want to talk about that. You know, I had enough of that at the church that I was at or whatever it was, and so I think we've come a long way. I think we have a long way to go, but I remember the first night 9 years ago when we brought up a whole series of financial issues, and it was just like a firestorm of people lighting up. And a lot of it was about, why are we talking about this? You know, it's like people didn't even want to talk about it, really. So I think that there is a hesitancy that somehow it's undharmic or something. I'm not sure quite what it is, but properly managing our money and making sure that it is supporting our mission and our vision is one of the dharmic missions of the board of directors and the entire organization, you know, to be responsible and to know about that and be transparent. So I think, as I mentioned last time, and I'm just going to comment on this and then move forward and we'll see what people want to talk about, I think we're bumping into the reality that for many communities, the Donna model, where everything is completely supported just on individual generosity, isn't working and probably is not going to work. That, and so many, many Dharma communities are looking to, you know, hybrid kinds of things, you know, that there's fees charged for retreats and certain classes, and some groups have moved to membership fees plus Donna for, you know, ongoing. So I think there's a lot of experimentation going on, and it's going to be just really interesting to see what happens to the new Buddhist model in this country. You know, in the Bay Area in Los Angeles, where you have, you know, this huge population and some of these huge sanghas operating exclusively on Donna looks one way. I mean, there's just tons of people and tons of money. And in some smaller communities where we don't have that, Donna looks really different. It looks different depending on what your objective is. You know, if you're just renting as opposed to buying a building. You know, so there's all these variations. But I think this is yet a, it is a piece that American Buddhism has to figure out. And it really has to figure it out if we want this to survive. You know, if we want to have teachers and instructors and mentors that are supported in a particular way, you know, I mean, we just have to figure it out, or it's going to be an interesting experiment, and it's not going to survive. I think we've been really fortunate. You know, we're sitting here; we pay $12 an hour, so which is a joke. It's so great, okay? Where the commercial rate for space of anything close to this. And we can't get, we need about 600 hours a year of time for all of our activities, one-day retreats, classes, what have you. There's just no place where we can get 600 hours in one place. The places where we can get it, the rental rates are up $20-$25 an hour. So down at this rate, we've had a wonderful relationship with the Friends, and it's allowed us to avoid addressing economic realities that a lot of other sanghas have had to deal with. And we're now, you know, Brian apologized for the parking, you know, we're now right on the cusp of kind of a crisis, because we've tried to rent parking across the street. They will not do it. We tried to rent parking around the corner. They won't do it. We maxed out on street parking. We're having people say that when they drive up and the street's filled up, they just keep driving. And we're going to start losing members. So at some point here, we've got to find a new home, and it's going to mean that we're going to be paying more. You know, so that's coming, and it'll be part of a discussion that I welcome. You know, I think this is the next stage of the maturing of this sangha. Okay, number three, sex.
Your voice cracked.
Excuse me. It would seem obvious that, you know, teachers and mentors and instructors and board members having sex with Sangha members, in other words, people in positions of control having sexual relations with people in lesser positions of control and power, it would just seem obvious that maybe there's something wrong with that. Okay? And apparently it's not obvious to a bunch of people, you know, because the history of spiritual communities in America is that this has been a problem. And it's been a problem not in this community, fortunately, but it has arisen its head on multiple occasions in Vipassana communities, both with foreign teachers who are brought here and American-grown teachers. So, I mean, this is just a reality. And it's this, for me, is actually just a variation of the first theme, which is power. Because this all has to do with a lot of projection about who somebody thinks somebody else is, and you know they want part of that, and then whoever that is having really poor boundaries and being attracted to somebody and exercising bad judgment, and you know it's, in the end it's all about everybody exercising bad judgment, but there's always somebody who has more power and is the senior person and should be exercising judgment, and they aren't. So as part of our training, those of us who've gone through the training at Spirit Rock and then the training that we've done here ourselves, you know, our community Dharma leaders training, we have all agreed to adhere to the Spirit Rock Code of Ethics. And there are specific provisions in that about relationships of anyone in a position of authority or control with anyone else in the community. And that's not just sexual. It's like a romantic relationship. So each one of these, in my opinion, you know, we have to be transparent and we have to really be straight with ourselves and we have to stay straight because it's just explosive stuff. You know, if there's abuses of authority, if there are problems with money, if there's problems with sex, it can just take a community down really, really quick, and particularly a small community. You know, it's one thing, I think we all know that some of the big communities in San Francisco have had really kind of dramatic problems around this, but they've survived because they're big communities. And they've got, you know, a strong governance. And it almost tore them apart, but they're able to survive. Smaller community like this, boy, you know, it can really take things apart. So exercising real care and authority is critical. Okay, number four.
I think I know what it might be.
Okay.
The need no longer exists in the community.
The need?
No longer exists in the community.
The need for what?
In the Dharma?
For the Sangha.
The need for the Sangha?
Right.
Okay. Well, that's interesting because, you know, the I guess it's how much you believe in the teachings, and then because it's all experiential, right? But the traditional model that we talked about in the first talk is that Sangha, and actually the need being the condition that leads to the present moment for community, is critical to each one of us individually awakening. Now, it's true. I mean, we know that there are these brilliant teachers who've gone off in caves primarily by themselves and become enlightened. I don't know. I'm not joining that group. And I'm really clear that, and I think the Buddha was right, that the presence of like a group like this is so critical for each one of our individual growth and, you know, heading towards awakening. So, but that's not it. Okay. Yes?
Gossip or some form of
Negative
thoughts about other people.
Well, that could be certainly part of it. It's not what I'm looking for, but yeah, I mean, huge, right? Huge. And so, like, you know, like I was saying earlier, if you have any kind of problem where the first three aren't being managed, and then you get the rumor mill going and the guy, you know, it's impossible to get it back in the box, you know? So, okay, so should I tell you? Okay, let's see, what is it? Okay, what it is, and this is about sanghas and the survival of sanghas, is volunteerism. I mean, it's not even something that anybody's going to think about, right? Okay, and everybody's heard about the 80-20 rule, you know, 20% of the objects have 80% of the value. Well, it's just the reverse in terms of manpower for sanghas. Okay, what was very clear to me in terms of talking, I mentioned that in my group at Spirit Rock, you know, almost all the sanghas, 80% of the sanghas, disbanded after 5 to 7 years. And one of the key reasons that happened was that there is a small group of people who are trying to do everything, hang the group together, and they just get burned out. And then they get exhausted, and then what started off is like just a pleasure, you know, and like an inspiration. People start feeling resentful, you know, like having to put in this time, and nobody's helping me, and nobody's stepping up. And this isn't endemic just to small spiritual communities, it's endemic to nonprofits. All nonprofits, small nonprofits, are facing the problem of there's a small group of people trying to make the thing work and having trouble getting people volunteering. That's the nature of the thing. So I think this is another thing that we somehow have to figure out. Because I mentioned in my first talk, and when I got this part of the talk, if you listen to the tape, I was kind of impassioned about it, was, you know, the original Sangha was based on the assumption of a deep, deep reciprocity between teachers and community and the Dharma and community. And the Dharma and the community, everyone in the community, having an obligation to maintain the Sangha and make it grow. That was just a given. And you can go in many places in Asia today and you can feel that. You know, I think when we were in Thailand in particular, you can just feel it. Now, they're practicing a completely different form of practice than we are, but you can feel this enormous sense of respect and relationship and reciprocity. And I think we have yet, by and large, to have that here in this country. You know, we are such individually based here. You know, everything is about individuals. And we are so entitled and don't know it that this idea that my being part of a community like this, actually in the middle of that, is an obligation that I want to take on. It's not an obligation that I have to do. It's because I love the Dharma and I love this community because it is keeping the Dharma alive and making the possibilities available to me, that I want to be part of that. And I don't know, you know, that's, for me at some level, that's part magic. Ultimately, completely pragmatic. And I think figuring out how we really, I think we talk about it as part of the way that we begin to grow that. But you know, just as an illustration, Vic stands up regularly and almost pleads with the group to get people to volunteer, you know, to come in and just help us set up and take down, you know. So, I mean, there are all of these different things that sustain a community like this, and I think in the next 6 months we're going to be looking at, there's going to be a lot of opportunities to contribute to this community. But I mean, just right now we have all kinds of things. I mean, just the simplest thing, I mean, you know, we all show up here and take advantage of this, and it just doesn't magically happen. It's like there's people who make this happen, you know. So set up and take down, facilitating one-day retreats, registration. You know, we constantly have been, we've been talking for years about creating a digital library for the board and of resources and things. We can never get to it because there's not we don't have enough energy. You know, so you know, we could go on for quite a while. There is an open position on the board. And, you know, it's like, it was saying, like with Vicki, it's kind of like people are pleading with the community for somebody to step up and be a board member. You know? Our relationship with SDC, the Sacramento Dharma Center, you know, there's positions at large. We have two members who are working really hard, kind of, I think they're at some level kind of getting burned out. And so, all of this. You know, I want to talk about this a lot, and I want us to re-envision this. You know, if everybody in this room agreed to donate 2 hours or 3 hours a month to this community, it'd be unbelievable what we could do. I mean, we used to, one thing that we used to regularly do once a quarter is take care of this, all of these grounds. That was our donor to the Friends. And we'd have a whole work day. We'd come in and we'd trim everything here. It was beautiful, you know? And those days were so much fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'd work all day long, you know, we'd come in, we're all, and we're done. It's like, wow, look at this, you know? I mean, it was tangible. Well, we don't do that anymore, you know? And I think the feeling's been like, well, we can't get the people to do it, you know? So, I know I am, and the board may be too. There's going to be a lot of discussion about this, but I know that I am going to be asking. I decided to come back in. You know, I'm president right now, and all of us who are sitting on that board are making a whole series of decisions about other things that we're not doing in our lives. So we can contribute to this organization. And I'm going to be talking a lot and asking all of you at some point to consider, just to consider, volunteering some time for this group and developing a whole set of options for people, whether you know, you've got accounting skills or computer skills or what have you. There's a lot of different things that we can do. But between now and the end of the year, I'm going to be sending up a flag and asking for your help. Okay, so those are the four things, and in any one of them, I think you know we could have multiple nights just on any one of those. So we've got a little bit of time. So comments, questions, arguments. Yes, in the back.
Just a comment that. Sort of consistent transparency about what's needed in terms of money and volunteer hours, I think would help address those issues. I think it's sort of like, you know, if you're in a relationship with somebody and then suddenly they drop on you that, you know, you always do this and you did it, you know, this time and this time and this time, and you think, well, why didn't you talk to me when I did it that first time? And it's sort of like if we're in a financial hole or people are burning out, and leaving, like let's nip this in the bud and let us know what's needed.
Yeah, first of all, thank you. And I think we have an obligation, and when I say we, anybody in a position of authority and having the gift of being able to guide the Sangha, we have an obligation to communicate and communicate well. And we may not have done that as well as we could have. So I think there will be more of that. And, you know, from, and I'm not speaking for the board now, but from my perspective, the issue at the moment is not financial. Okay. We have, in the sake of transparency, we have about $60,000 in our investments in bank account right now. Okay. So once we find a place to get away from this parking problem, our expenses are going to go up, and I'm sure that there, until the community adjusts over on a Donna basis to understanding what it takes, that we're probably going to delete some of those funds. Okay. At the moment, the problem isn't financial at the moment. The problem is a human resource issue. And I don't think we've been either aggressive enough or haven't figured out how to communicate what the need is. Okay? So what my opinion is that what we need to do is define a series of things and then come out to the community and ask for them. And having said that, okay, you know, we, right now, the person who has been heading up our St. John's dining effort, okay, has need to pull back for some health reasons. And, you know, we've had multiple in our e-news announcements about this. You know, we haven't heard a peep from anybody about trying to help us on that. So, you know, there's a combination of, well, here's how we need help, but then obviously we have to figure out how to make help attractive. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to this idea of, I think that there are some premises about our culture and our relationship to the Dharma and organizations like this that somehow we have to figure out, you know. So
we're struggling with that. The Sacramento Dharma Center is also struggling with the idea of volunteers. And one of the things that we want to promote is the fact that volunteering at some of the simple jobs like St. John's or doing the sit up and takedown, this is all Dharma practice.
Yeah.
This is stuff we should be, you know, doing to practice.
Yeah. I see, I think this is an important piece of this, like the, you know, I emphasize that statement that we read before the board meeting, the opening line is that the way we're going to conduct the meeting, what we're going to pay attention to, is a practice in and of itself. It's not like, okay, we're coming together to have a meeting of the corporation. No, we're coming together to practice the Dharma in this particular form. So if we view volunteerism as, well, it's something I have to do, you know, okay, all right, you know, Dennis laid this big trip on us, you know, okay, you know, I got to volunteer 2 hours on the, you know, like, it's like something you have to do. Well, don't do it, you know. Seriously, I mean, that's not what this is about. What this is about is that this community and what we're offering is of some real value to you, and you're interested in sustaining that value, and so that coming and setting up the chairs or taking the room down is all practice. I mean, you know, what did the Buddha say? We're trying to develop what? Moment-to-moment, non-judgmental awareness, okay? And it doesn't matter what you're doing. It doesn't matter if you're in walking meditation, sitting meditation, setting up chair meditation, putting the chairs away meditation. It's, you know, in the end, what this is about is just what this says. Our mission is to serve as a learning, training, and community center for the development, integration, and skillful use of meditation practice and awareness in all aspects. There's no exceptions here. It doesn't say exceptions. It says all aspects of individual, family, institutional work, and community life. You know, any place that we are not mindful, we are not mindful. Every place that we are mindful is pointing our minds towards awakening.
And well, I know I'm preaching to the choir here somewhat, but Sacramento Insight Meditation emphasizes the meditation, meditative awareness part, but in the practice of Buddha development, there are other things besides meditation. But, you know, the other things are equally important in other places of the practice. And so that's another way we can approach volunteerism for people is generosity, you know, maybe as an aspect. I don't know whether it puts Celia into that, but somehow, you know, it's not just what you do on the cushion.
Yeah,
it's not just applying meditative awareness while you're doing your task. It's actually the benefit to you for doing something for somebody else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I had a discussion with you about this a couple of months ago. I had never volunteered before. And partly it was because I didn't really think I had anything, any particular skills to offer. And I've always been horrifically insecure. So I would never risk it on any kind of a level at all until when you started to step back. Whenever that was, 5 years ago or something, and he said, well, if you value this community, see what you can do. And Diane had already suggested me to work on the newsletter, so that was my entree into doing stuff. And so what I'm finding it has done for me and my practice is that it's expanded it in a different direction that has to do with actually getting to know a lot of you in ways I would have never known before, and to see the inner workings of the way an organization like this goes, but it's also been a personal learning about what I actually can do. So one of the things that I always want to say, if I can open my mouth in a situation like this, is don't hold back, because you don't have to know how to do this stuff. I've never been on a board before, and I've managed to wander through for a while, and quite frankly, I am a little burned out at this point because I've been doing it for a long time. But you really learn a lot about practice and about how to interact and about how important this stuff really is. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It's been a tremendous learning experience, dharmic learning experience
for me. Yeah, so much out of it. And, you know, kind of to combine this and what Michael said is that, you know, in the end, what is practice about? Yeah, it's, it's about relationship. So whether it's a relationship with a state of mind or a relationship with another person, you know, this is where really the rubber hits the road. So this form of practice where we're working with other people and have to bring the full skill set that we're trying to develop that the Buddha offered of, you know, ethical conduct, kindness, compassion, you know, the whole thing, then it becomes a workshop and this really rich experience. And so I've always felt that service, and that's what it is, it's service, in this way, I'm always walking away with much more than I'm giving. You know, as hard as I may be working, I mean, what I get out of it, you know, what I learn in terms of making the Dharma a real living thing, just like the mission statement, you know, in my individual life, in my work life, in my community life, in my institutional life, it is unbelievable. And probably no other way that I could get it, because I'm working with a bunch of other people with the same intention. That's the thing. I mean, you know, how often do we sit in a room with this many people, all of whom at some level are trying to cultivate these beautiful set of qualities of mind? You know, it's an extraordinary thing. It's the value of community. So working together, whether it's at St. John's or on the board or, you know, facilitating a retreat or setting up and taking down, you're having this interaction with like-minded people that are supporting your state of mind.
I've been involved in another life with developing a volunteer base and trying to keep it going. And one of the things, it may sound like it's counter to what Linnell was saying, which is a leap in and just do it and see what you can learn. Not necessarily antithetical, but I think you sort of need to develop job descriptions.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the time commitment.
Yep.
So people can fairly understand the forgiveness when you know, everybody thinks that means 52 weeks out of the year I've got to do this. You need to know that there's forgiveness or backup.
But it, when Joette said the St. John's thing, I mean, little things like St. John, organizing St. John, and I was sitting here going, are you, really? That sounds so intimidating to me. So I think it would be helpful if there were, like, descriptions and time commitments and what that's all about, and how your team has to work and things like, just the specificity would be helpful.
Yeah. I agree, and thank you for that. You know, this is just an illustration, okay? Like, the idea, I mean, I came from where I practiced and with my teachers that you would never walk into a Dharma setting with a room this size and not have flowers up here as a way of honoring what's going on, you know? And it's one of the conditions that sets an environment. You know, I mean, I could go on for quite a while about what flowers here means, okay? But at the simplest level, we just have some little simple system that somebody's in charge of, that we're always going to have flowers here every Thursday night, you know, and that people volunteer to bring flowers, okay, and that there's a coordinator for that. I mean, this just the simplest thing. But if we don't have that in place, what happens? It doesn't happen.
And I think also the simple thing of making a commitment to show up every Thursday night, mm-hmm. to be serious about learning about the Dharma. I mean, we know it alleviates suffering, but it doesn't if people show up once every month or two. It becomes irrelevant if it's not an ongoing practice.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
I'd say something about the website, if I could. I've been doing the website for at least 4 years by myself, and it's time somebody would help me with it. It's not a huge task, but to keep it updated, to keep the talks going, to keep everything going. You know, I took it from Renee because I made a comment about, wow, I'm sure it's taking a long time to get the talks up. I incorporated that. So I don't really want to go to that extreme of slowing down like a work stoppage. But, you know, I've been asking for help for probably 2 years.
So then what you and I are going to do is Margaret's suggestion, is we're going to create a little job description and put some hours on it and see if somebody wants to help out.
And it's all basic stuff. I mean, it's real basic. Renee taught me, and I'm pretty naive on this stuff. So the coordinator at St. John's, I've done that. It was the people before you that you take over the position, they instruct you and mm-hmm. on the setup, everything. Vic has a real nice layout with pictures even of how the room should look, and all the positions have beautiful descriptions from the previous owner. So yeah. Anyway, so
you know, like, the reason we have this here is that all of our talks end up on the website, and it's amazing how many people rely on those website talks. You know, just the simple task of somebody being responsible for this and then getting it up on the website within the next couple of days is like this huge, hugely valuable thing, you know. And I would just like to comment. This is Brian McKenzie who is speaking here, and Brian, there's a handful of people who really contribute an enormous amount of time. Brian contributes an enormous amount of time times 10. Seriously, you know, if there's somebody that deserves the Extraordinary Service Award, it's Brian. I'm really serious about this, and I'm publicly thanking him. And, you know, Brian and I have talked about this many times, and he and I both feel the same way, you know, is that, like, the amount of time we put in, both of us feel like we're getting so much more out of this than the time that we're putting in. The satisfaction level of, you know, making this a living thing is hard to explain. Yeah. One more. Yeah.
Yeah, Dennis, you know, you and I have talked about some of this too, how the Western mind is so different than the Eastern mind and how we see things, you know. And one of the things that I learned profoundly was working in the Tibetan Buddhist community about the preciousness of Dharma. We don't talk about that a lot in the Western traditions and stuff, but to them, it is such a precious thing. I mean, they don't even put their teaching books on the floor. That's considered such a disrespectful thing. And ritual is very important to them to keep their consciousness focused on Dharma. And the other thing is, we live in a country that we take a lot of things for granted. And you've traveled outside of the country. Other people have gone on these pilgrimages. I've spent a lot of time out in the country in other monasteries. I've been to Tibet. And you see the suffering that goes on, the struggle that they have to put up with from their government agencies and the problems and politics and war and violence. And then, you know, we have such freedom in this country, and we take a lot of it for granted. And I think understanding Dharma as a precious gift that we have to give to the community is another kind of way to hold it so that we can share in that together.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Yeah. Okay, so we're out of time. I'd like to thank all of you for coming tonight. It's great to see a group this size, and also I want to thank you for your openness just to consider all of this, because I think that, you know, it's easy to get triggered around this kind of discussion. Okay, so I want to be really clear that I'm, you know, there's a difference. I actually had a discussion with someone today about the difference between having a good intention and then, you know, you're saying something that's received in a different way than your intention. So, you know, my intention in this is for the best interest of the community and the best interest of everyone here. And I'm not criticizing anyone. And what I am trying to do is, in some way, try to raise all of our awareness of key issues and start a discussion. You know, so I really welcome your thoughts. I think any of our board members, if you have thoughts or ideas about any of these things, we want to hear from you. And then I think you'll see that there's going to be more structured discussion about some of these things and opportunities in the next 6 or 8 months. Okay. So, you know, in a world where there's so much suffering, these discussions, I think, are critical, because a community like this, what we do just ripples out into the Sacramento community and onward. I received an email from someone who attended a basic meditation class here 11 years ago and then moved out of town. And they saw my little website. They didn't know how to get in touch with me, so they said, "I just wanted to let you know how valuable that class was in your community, offering that class. It changed my life, and it's affected everything I've done since then." They're back in Cincinnati someplace. You know, we haven't heard from them from 11 years. So it is. It's just a web. You know, it just spreads out, and so it's a thing of beauty. And so thank you very much.